Kendry Páez, Renato Ibarra, Zavala, buen disparo, gol de Independiente del Valle, golazo del Niño Maravilla, golazo de Kendry Páez.
Hello and welcome along to Wilson and Windsor's Libertadores podcast, one of the very, very few podcasts in English exclusively dedicated to South America's premier club competition, the Copa Libertadores. Myself, David Windsor, and Mr. Oliver Juice Wilson. Here, he doesn't like that. He's squirming. Mr. Oliver Wilson, we can cut it out if you want.
No, we'll leave the squirm. Don't worry.
Sat in my pad in the north of the city of Buenos Aires, Argentina, where we are here covering the games, all the games of the Copa Libertadores. Ollie.
I like the description of the north of the city, which is actually, it's like the northern part of the small bit of the city that we tend to stay in around it.
But yeah, we stay in the north of the north of the north.
We're now in the north of the north.
But look, Ollie, I want to start by talking about a young footballer that has caught our eye during the group stages of this competition. And I actually think there's a responsibility on journalists not to over-egg how good a teenager is, not to put too much pressure on their shoulders. So I'm just going to say this. Kendry Páez, 16-year-old Ecuadorian, possibly the greatest young talent in a generation.
Just to simmer it down a bit. There's a lot of hype.
As low as I can go. His name's Kendry Páez. He's Ecuadorian. He's been signed by Chelsea. I think they're loaning him out to Strasbourg. He currently plays for Independiente del Valle. And Ollie and I in the taxi the other day to work were trying to find the best parallel to someone that watches European football. And the closest that I could come to is probably Phil Foden. Not just because he's left-footed, but just the style of play, the position, the fact that he's got a goal in him, the way he plays between the lines, even like his gait and his style and like his physical appearance. So the Ecuadorian Phil Foden, Kendry Páez, going to be a superstar. Discuss, Mr. Wilson.
There's not much to discuss, is there? That is the tagline, the summation. I wouldn't say he is the best talent in a generation. I think that is definitely putting a little too much weight on the young lad's shoulders. Ooh. What I would say is he is the best player that I have seen in South American football of all ages on this continent since 2019. There isn't a player, young or old, that I've seen control a game in that same way. He is better than Bruno Henrique was when he was running the show with Flamengo at their best. He's better than Honey was at his best for Palmeiras.
Obviously. Julian Alvarez for River.
Yeah.
Moises Caicedo.
He controls the game. And I think it's more impressive that he's doing it at a level when he's 16 years old. I think that's incredible. We discussed, obviously, that maybe there's some off-the-field stuff that needs to be stamped out if he's going to focus and, you know, be that guy that goes to the next level, have that psychopathic mentality of I'm in training every day, last one out, first one in kind of thing. But I watched him against Palmeiras this week. Incredible. He scores a wonderful goal, but it's not just about the goal. It's the way that he completely dictated the first 45 minutes of that game and was the leader of the kind of fight to hold on to the advantage when Palmeiras decided to eventually turn up. And the Independiente del Valle style of football suits what he's doing with that team perfectly.
Yeah, we won't go too much into it because we covered it last week on the pod, Ollie, but obviously he was in a New York strip club.
Go back and listen.
Go back and please listen to it. He was in it because we talked about that in depth. He was in a New York strip club kind of fairly recently, but you know, he's a kid, he sort of makes mistakes and there we are. I think, yeah, since we started covering football on this continent in 2019, I think you could look at Julian Alvarez and say, like, wow, that incredible talent, obviously gone to Manchester City now. Moises Caicedo hasn't quite lived up to it, really, but I mean, he's great at Brighton, clearly.
He did it over the last few years.
But I just think, for me, Kendry Páez is more exciting than either of those two were. You know, the scouts at Chelsea they've got an absolute gem. If you can keep on the straight and narrow. I loved his goal. So he scored. Independiente del Valle lost against Palmeiras 3-2 in the end, but they were 2-0 up in the game. Independiente del Valle, this tiny football club in Ecuador. And I loved his goal, Ollie, because he plays like a couple of 1-2s almost within like a 5-yard radius. before the ball sits up. And I don't think many would take that strike on because it actually bobbles up slightly at him, which maybe helps him. But, I mean, incredible confidence. I mean, he knows it. Like, he absolutely knows it. The swagger he plays with is just ridiculous.
But you'd have that swagger. I mean, yeah. I remember being a young kid playing football in the park.
There was always
that one kid that was better than everybody else who, you know, they had trials at Watford or something like that and never made it, but they were head and shoulders above everybody else. And they played with that kind of same confidence above everybody else around them. If you were 16... and you knew you were going to one of the biggest clubs in European football, one of the richest clubs on the planet, you would have that swagger because this is now a no-pressure child's play for him. He can play like he's playing on the streets, like he's playing in the back garden with his mates. I actually think in talking about the goal he scored, his movement is great and the vision to play the 1-2s, but it's the instinctive nature that they come back to him as well, which I also... It's always my worry about some players if they find a system and a style that works perfectly for them. And hopefully when he's playing around better players, nothing to discredit the players of South America, but when he's playing with the elite players in the Premier League, at Chelsea and European football in general, that will come even quicker to him, those sorts of return passes, those ideas. Because he's playing a step ahead of everybody else right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's fantastic.
He's great.
He's so great to watch. All right, Ollie, let's...
But does he make it?
I think he makes it.
I'd love to see him make it.
I think he makes it. I think he's... It would take an injury or a massive shift in mentality for him not to make it. I think
he's... But he's so young that there is a possibility of that shift, you know? Like, that's the trouble is, because he is young, and I don't know if I said it last week or not, but like I would... If I was Chelsea, I'd get my investment out of here now. He's showing what he can do at this stage. He's composed enough to be able to handle the pressure of... the South American equivalent of the Champions League. Get him out of here. Get him wrapped under cotton wool slightly in a stricter, healthier regime perhaps for him and see what happens.
I don't disagree with that. I just think that he doesn't move to Chelsea for another year. And I think because he turns 18, he turns 17, sorry, in next month. So, you know, he moves to
next
Chelsea.
Next week, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Which is also next month.
It does work.
I think that a year... The next year he's going to spend at IDV is going to be so valuable, though, Ollie, because IDV, the small club, you know, he's playing in the Ecuadorian league. There's no fucking eyeballs on him there at all.
Yeah.
And I also think that those trips that he's going to have to take in the Libertadores, hopefully they qualify for the last 16. If they don't, they'll probably drop into the Sudamericana, which itself is its own kind of rough and tumble madhouse. So, I just think it's awesome. While we're talking about young players... I just want to reference a few other players that popped up this week. Franco Mastantuono at River scored the winner for them. Doesn't quite have the utter dominance of a game like Kendry Pyes. Obviously, it's a big ask, but you know he's playing for River at 16. He's obviously a really good player, and they've got such a history of bringing players through. Echeverri as well at River, who scored the other week. Fantastic footballer. Endrick, haven't seen too much of. Obviously, there's loads of talk about him. I mean, everyone in European football has probably heard of Endrick, I'd say. How many people who follow European football have heard of Kendry Pyes? Like 1%, maybe 0.1%.
Well, it was the
Andy
selling
Brassel
point
and us, like, you know,
it was the selling point for this week, wasn't it? The Endrick against Kendry Pyes, Independiente del Valle taking on Palmeiras, and actually Endrick started, which again I saw BeIN Sport USA's tweet that had the two of them on it, like the next great players kind of going head to head. And taking something out of my social media, I think, actually, to be honest. But yeah, it was interesting to see that and actually Endrick starting and playing pretty much the full 90 minutes. He scored as well in the fight back for Palmeiras, showed his quality in front of goal. Palmeiras were poor in the first half of that game, so we didn't see the best of Endrick. But in the second half, he was much better, much more influential. He's just not in the same place to be able to influence a game in the same way as Kendry Pyes does, because Pyes is in that number 10 role, whereas Endrick is playing the majority of his football out on the flank. So while he can obviously make some sort of impact from the flank, it's not the same as being the guy in the heart of the pitch pulling the strings, basically.
So from young players on the continent to older players, Ollie, I know you've got a list that you're going to reel off here. And I think it's worth saying that, you know, if you follow European football and don't follow South American football, Some names over the years, some South American names, you will certainly know, and you will be absolutely certain that they don't play football anymore, but they do. They play in the Libertadores. I messaged a mate of mine, shout out to Ollie, who's a Blackburn fan, And I said, mate, you must have watched a lot of Rocco Santa Cruz back in the day, right? When he was coming, like, did great things at Blackburn, went on to things. And I was like, mate, he's still on the bench for Libertad at 42 years of age. And my mate Ollie texts back and was like, how is that possible? He had injury problems in his 20s and, like, couldn't get out the physio room in his 20s. And fucking 15 years later, or 10 years later, he's still on the bench for, like, Libertad, not a tiny club, Ollie.
This no, there's
like
expectation on them to perform at this level to some grade. And it's, I don't know whether it's the affection and the, I think South American football, this is one of the best things about South American football, is that you have the connection that players have with the club because it's the members club, because there is the socios, and it feels more like there's an association and affiliation between the players and the members than the players and European football fans, let's say, because they are kind of the hired mercenaries at that point, which is why I think you also see a lot of these players going back to their roots, back to South American football, to play for the clubs that they began with, because they may have been, you know, members of that club as a child, let alone on the books of an academy or something, gone there with their dad when they were young, so they have even more of an affiliation to the club. Maybe that's why, you know, someone like Rocky Santa Cruz is back at Libertad and he's just still got that connection. But is it useful?
I love it.
I mean, it's got to be useful for some purpose, whether it's marketing or otherwise. Is it useful because it keeps people in European football? You know, 100 people a year will wiki Rocky Santa Cruz, where is he now? Or Google search or whatever. Mm. And suddenly, oh, bloody hell, he's still playing at Libertad. What are they doing? God, they're in the Conmebol Libertadores. Jeez, I can't believe it. So
I think before we hear Ollie's list, you got your list right, Ollie.
Yeah, I got the list.
Of all the players who you might have heard of playing Europe and now back and kind of in their late 30s, early 40s. I just wanted to say something that I picked up on this week that I thought was really funny was the Libertad's boss is 27 years old and his striker, Oscar Cardoso, also had a spell at Benfica back in the day, is 40. And he's got Rocky Santa Cruz, who's 42, on the bench. So, like, Rocky Santa Cruz could be his dad. Mm. Like, that's insane.
Like, might well be. It might be why he's still around at the club. Go on, lad. Just keep us on the bench. I can do a job for you.
But imagine, like, you're 27 and you're bossing around a 42-year-old.
A 42-year-old that's played at almost the highest level possible in European football. Like, has had a very good career, not just in South America, but elsewhere. But you get that now in... Who's the lad in German football who was a football manager?
Nagelsmann.
Yeah. No, the English kid who got the job from his first job in football management because of the video game Football Manager.
Oh, I don't know.
And now he's managing in the Bundesliga. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how do players look at him and go, what is...
But Nagelsmann was like late 20s, wasn't he, I think? I don't think he was even 30 when he first got his job.
Maybe not, no. So he was young. I mean, you do get young managers.
Doesn't happen in England.
England's different, though. There's this weird, like, expectation level that every other manager that comes in has to be, like, a superstar who's, you know, oh, you've done it in the farming leagues of French and Italian football, so prove that you can do it in England in the championship, yeah? So I don't know about... There's a lot of problems with English football.
Let's hear the list.
All right. I mean, I sent this across to a couple of people, and they were shocked. So the one that you highlighted to me that I didn't realise until a few days ago was Manuel Lanzini, former West Ham, now at River Plate.
Only 31.
Yeah. I mean, you'd argue he's just on the back end of the best of his years, right? 32 is when you think, ooh, okay, falling off a cliff. So the De Silva brothers, Fabio and Rafael, they're at Grêmio and Botafogo, respectively, right now. A lot of these guys are at Brazilian clubs, funnily enough. Luis Gustavo is playing at Sao Paulo, former Bayern Munich man. Rafinha is at Sao Paulo as well. James Rodriguez, I mean, this one, he was one of the best players on the planet at one point and scored that unbelievable goal at the World Cup and the world was his oyster. And now he's back at Sao Paulo as well. I mean, you look at that. James Rodriguez, Rafinha, Luis Gustavo. That's three great players to have in your side. Mm-hmm. Marcelo is at Fluminense, who maybe a lot of people saw, obviously, last year. With the Copa Libertadores final actually being broadcast in the UK. Felipe Melo at Fluminense as well.
40 or 41 by now.
Yeah, 41, yeah. Carlos Bacca. This one, Great. Surprised me. And at Junior as well, back in Colombia. I mean, he did nothing for Milan, but Bagger had some excellent seasons in Italian football. Arturo Vidal is now at Colo-Colo. Still got the Mohawk as well, so he stands out nicely. Rocky Santa Cruz, obviously a Libertad. Hulk at Atletico Mineiro, the big burly striker, who's their starting centre-forward as well at 37 years old. It's not like he's Roque Santa Cruz waiting in the wings. Most of these guys are starting on a regular basis.
Back of starts, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Diego Costa, like, I mean, the fire and intensity of Diego Costa is perfect and horrible at the same time in the Libertadores. Because you remember what he was at Atletico Madrid, and now you see what he's become at Gremio, where he's just trying to fight and headbutt, and he should have been sent off on match day two of the Libertadores. And the one that I didn't expect to see, Gaston Ramirez, former Middlesbrough and Southampton player at Peñarol, and almost scored a worldie from about 35 yards out, struck the post with one of those hitting the valve knuckleballs from a free
3-2 down as well, they were. 3-0 down, sorry. Came back to 3-2. And then Gaston Ramirez has a free kick last minute from 40 yards. And if that goes in, then, well.
Yeah, I was going to take the top off the commentary booth on that one when we were watching it. But yeah, that's... That is a good list of kind of all-stars. It's lacking some defensive ability. I know David Luiz is here as well, but I'm not sure he's kind of like a forgotten guy yet, because he was quite iconic as an individual in world football anyway. So we just need to bolster it. It's a great forward lineup. We've got a couple of fullbacks in the De Silva brothers. Felipe Melo could drop into a centre-back role if you need to. And then, yeah, we just need maybe another centre-back or two to kind of just solidify the back line.
Another one I want to add, Ollie, that's a bit of an odd one is Rafael Santos Borré, just because he had a great sort of brief spell at Eintracht Frankfurt, where I believe he scored the winning penalty in the Europa League final. He did. He scored the equaliser in the final against Rangers, then he went on to score the winning penalty. So if you're a fan of kind of Eintracht Frankfurt or German football, you'll certainly remember him. And he's an unusual one for me because he's 28, so he should be in his absolute prime. Like, scored in the 2019 Libertadores final, and then kind of went to Eintracht Frankfurt after that, and you'd think, oh, wow, okay, you'll be in European football for the next sort of 5 years and maybe go back when you're mid-30s. So for him to be back now in South American club football at 28 doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me, but there he is.
He's squandering chances, so it's starting. The more I've seen of Internacional, the more I'm realising why he's maybe not still in European football. And again, I don't want to keep kind of pushing this idea of like European football is the best and it's the ultimate. But at the end of the day, there is realisms that have to be accepted at this point, that South American football just doesn't have the ability to compete with European football. Even the draw of Saudi leagues and MLS right now is causing a real problem for Argentinian football in particular. Brazilian football is slightly different, of course. But yeah, Santos Borré does not have the Midas touch in front of goal. I think he probably averages about 15 chances, one completed, one converted. So it's not... It's not exactly a prolific goal scorer.
No,
rate.
He's a bit of a loner of a striker as well. He's not like, he's a bit, Ewan described Miguel Borja this week as like a bit of an island, which I quite like as a description of a striker. And I feel like Borre's like that as well. Doesn't really dovetail with anyone. He's sort of wandering around by himself a bit. 20 minutes can go by if you're commentating on him and you're like, I haven't mentioned this guy's name in 20 minutes. Like, yeah, it feels odd.
He's not bringing others into the game at all.
No, like different to a River when he was sort of playing with Matias Suarez and like bouncing off Nacho Fernandez and all of that. So, yeah, a bit of an odd one to keep your eye on for sure. I want to talk about Renato the Goat Gaucho. Why don't you like him, Ollie?
I don't dislike him. I mean, I prefer Kuka and the shirts underneath the tracksuit top still. I'd forgot about those until this week with Atletico Mineiro. No,
this is why I like him.
Okay.
So, well, apart from the fact that I love a coach who's so embedded with the club that he won the Libertadores as a player with Gremio in like the late 80s. Then he won it as a coach with Gremio in like 2017. Gremio won the Libertadores three times. He's been part of two of those three occasions. So he's so attached to the football club. Anyway, Gremio lost their first two games of the Libertadores. Basically went to Estudiantes de La Plata and had to win essentially. And they were down to 10. And in a game they needed to win. And Renato Gaucho throws on two teenagers, and I was thinking as he did it, you can only do that because you're Renato Gaucho, in the sense that if you're a boss that's really worried you're just about to lose your job, or you don't feel like you've got enough weight at the football club, or the fans are on your back, I don't think you're doing that down to 10. But Renato Gaucho's literally been like, fuck it, like, we need to win this game. If we lose 3 out of 3 and drop into the Sudamericana or worse, then so be it. And so he's thrown on two teenagers. Nathan Fernandez has scored the winner for him on 75 minutes, set up by the other teenager whose name escapes me at the moment. and Gremio now, like, in what is a really tight Group C, where 2 points currently separate the four sides, are still in a fantastic position to qualify, because they've got two of their last three games at home. I think they will qualify, actually. They're away at Huachipato and then home against the Estudiantes and home against the Strongest. So, yeah, I don't know. I just thought, I like Renato Gaúcho. I like what he did at Gremio kind of when we were around in 2019, 2020. And I know you're about to say, well, the Brazilian side should be winning and he shouldn't have lost his first two. But I just thought, one more thing I want to say here. What makes a good manager these days, Ollie? Because I don't think it's the transfer market, because other people do that. I don't even think it's coaching players, because by the time you've got a footballer now, he's been coached out of his life since he was about 5 years old. So when you get a player and he's 27 or 22 or 31 or 41, like, he's been coached. You can't improve him, really. Maybe a percentage here or there. So what are you looking for a manager now in 2024? And what I'm looking for is someone that can change the game as it's happening. Rather than back in the day, right, it was probably more, who are you going to sign? Can you actually improve these players? Are you a great coach out there in the training pitch? Now, I personally think it's, how can you change what's happening in front of you? And that double substitution, I thought, was just fucking immense. And, like, at the end of the game, he's also in this embrace with these two teenagers. And he's just like, wow, yeah, like, you... Like, he loves himself, Renato Gaúcho. But in that moment, I was like, yeah, that's a great sub.
You took the words out of my mouth in terms of what a good manager is the ability to make tactical adjustments on the fly, read and react to, and admit when you got a game plan wrong and change it and alter it to be able to get it right. That's what we saw Peñarol do this week. It's also what we saw Abel Ferreira do with Palmeiras on numerous occasions, both successfully taking them to the Libertadores final and winning it, and unsuccessfully when he tried to adapt when it was too little too late against Boca in the semi-finals last year. And he's done it on two match days this year already in the group stage. I also think man management is massively key. Being able to change the way you handle different players and different people. I mean, you look at the way that... this is criminal. Jackson, the Chicago Bulls coach back in the day.
American sportman.
Yeah, sorry. But like, Dennis Rodman went off to Las Vegas for a few days during the playoffs. And he was like, look, Dennis needs to do what Dennis needs to do, rather than reading him the right act, was just like, look, you get back here and you play basketball and we win games. And so knowing that, he wouldn't give other people that sort of kind of length of string to be able to toe the line.
Dennis North Korea Rodman.
Yeah, yeah. The man, the myth, the legend, the greatest rebounder of all time in the NBA. I think that is a real key ability. I think that's where a lot of managers that we've seen in European football have gone wrong. I think it's where some managers, like Daniele De Rossi, for instance, I think has come in and done that with this Roma side, has known exactly how to treat them compared to how Jose Mourinho was dealing with them, kind of reading them the right act every other day, throwing people under the bus when they didn't play well, all that kind of stuff. And Renato Gaúcho has shown that by masterminding a comeback this week when they had to. I didn't see any tactical changes taking place against Huachipato on match day two, however. I didn't really see Gaúcho changing the game at all or being inspirational. What I saw was a manager that got himself into a hole with a side that they should have been walking past. And I think, and I may be wrong, and if I'm wrong, I apologise, but there was a Comebol Sudamericana campaign where Gremio dominated the group stage. And you're like, no one's going to touch them. And as soon as it got actually to the meat and potatoes of the Comebol Sudamericana and the knockout stages, it wasn't their best. And if that, I'm pretty sure that was Renato Gaúcho at that point. And it was, again, knockout football is different to group stage football. Maybe they'll have a better chance this year with the attitude they've got in the group stage in knockout football this year. But I just don't, see it. Not much impresses me about Brazilian sides at the moment in general as a larger point this season. They've all played about 45 minutes of football a game whenever I've seen them. And the rest of the time, they've buckled. Atletico Mineiro went 3-0 up and then almost buckled against Peñarol. Let them back into it in the second half after about 50 minutes. Conceded on 60 and then went all over the place. Gremio were on the verge of being out of this competition before this week. Abel Ferreira's Palmeiras have twice had to come back from rocky first halves last week and this week. Or match day two and match day three, I should say, sorry, to get themselves back into games that... Look, Independiente Del Valle is probably the toughest test they'll have. Shouldn't have been the same level of difficulty that they had on match day two, however. So I think there's an overconfidence of the Brazilian side, which it just takes one team to pick them off. who that team is, I'm still not sure yet. The one I think is maybe Independiente Del Valle. No bias.
Yeah, so just to Windsor's betting corner and following up from what you're saying there, Ollie, if you look at the favourites to win it, Flamengo, 3-1, Palmeiras, 4-1, River, basically 5-1, Atletico Mineiro, 6-1, Fluminense, 7s. Like, it's all Brazil, and then it's like Grêmio, Botafogo, it's all Brazilian clubs, apart from River, who I don't think will win it because they don't have enough. But if I was a betting man, I'd be putting £10 on IDV at 40-1. Mm. That is saying, if you're not a betting person, that is saying if this tournament was played from this point 40 times, they'd only win it once, which I don't think is true. Because they're still, like, they can still qualify from the group. And if they qualify from the group, that 40-1 comes down to about 10-1. Because they've scored three past Palmeiras. And I didn't watch the game, fair enough. But like, they're 3-0 up against Palmeiras. Like, how many sides have the capacity to do that? Like, say, they were 2-0 up, sorry, 2-0 up on it, yeah. They're 2-0 up against Palmeiras. Like, you know, who does that kind of thing? It's very rare. And I think they could do it. I actually think Bolivar, who've won 3 from 3 in the groups, I think there's something about them. We know that, like, altitude will help them out at home.
Going to La Paz,
yeah. There's a bit of that. Liga de Quito always feel like they've got something about them, although I watched them once in a 90-minute game this season. I'm not totally convinced, but yeah, I'm not impressed by the Brazilian clubs either, but I still think a Brazilian club's going to win it, obviously. I don't know. That's what we like the least.
If you look at names right now, right, I'm just going to very quickly run through the groups and pick out the ones that could potentially get through and be contenders, right? Fluminense, haven't seen enough of them. Can't imagine them retaining it just because it's so difficult to anyway. Colo-Colo, no. Cerro Porteño, absolutely not. They were a disaster when I saw them against Alianza Lima. Haven't impressed at all. Can't score goals. Group B, Tajeres. Now, our man JC, John Cotterill, has been bigging them up in terms of like they're playing good spells through a 90 minutes and quite exciting to watch. Not had a chance to watch a 90 minutes of them yet. Sao Paulo, no, I don't. There's something not right about Sao Paulo. They've got a cluster of great players that can't really play together, I think. Barcelona, an interesting one. Mainly just because there's probably a bit of affection from a few years ago still left over.
Possibly. And you know what? Like I said this in last week's pod. I mean, the first two games, they conceded like an equaliser with like the last kick of the game. So they should, in inverted commas, have 4 more points than they do, but they don't. And then they got beaten at home against São Paulo, but they had a couple of great chances at 1-0 down against São Paulo. But, you know, at the moment, they're not going to qualify. They need to win their last three games.
Group C is such a crapshoot right now. I don't know who's going through in that, let alone who's going to be potentially contending in the knockout stages. Junior flattered to deceive on numerous years when we've been covering this competition. Liga de Quito might be there. Botafogo should be higher up in that group as well, but at least it's a very tight one. It'll go down to the wire. You mentioned Bolivar already. Flamengo haven't really got out of the blocks, but they didn't in 2019 until the quarterfinals, and then suddenly weaved a mind tapestry on us that made us think that they were amazing for the whole of that competition for some reason. Palmeiras and Independiente Del Valle, without a doubt, I'd say are the best, most attractive footballing sides, and IDV do it for 90 minutes, whereas Palmeiras seem to do it for 45. Rosario, not really. Peñarol, not good enough. Atletico Mineiro could, and they've got a very good squad as well.
Scarpa as well, doing well for them at the moment.
Very good. Yeah. Two wonderful goals this week. Excellent finishes. And then River Plate, you've already said you're not sold on yet.
Mainly because the guy that I get my yogurt and ice cream from doesn't fancy them at all. Okay. Doesn't like Di Michaelis, doesn't fancy them. I'm not sure about River, no.
I don't fancy Di Michaelis either.
Looks great, though. But
as in, he's aged well, like a nice
he's
Malbec.
Yeah, like very, yeah, absolutely fine wine. I think as I'm comparing them to what they were on a Gachado in 2019, that's not really fair.
No. But it's a high standard they set for themselves. Mm. And it's not too dissimilar a squad. There's still a lot of players from the Gachado era lingering around that side. They have lost key figures on it.
And we've also got, you know, Nacho Fernandez is kind of still there. He's not as good as he was. I think if you could do any kind of comparison, which, as you say, that was the bar they set, but Miguel Borja is nowhere near as good as the strikers they had before. You know, they just had so much quality before, yeah. But I don't think they're going
to
win it.
No. So right now, if you were asking me to pick a winner of the Libertadores, I'd put Independiente Del Valle in my top eight easily. Well, and in the knockout stage of a competition. Also, the fact that they get to play on their own ground, which, you know, it's been for the last few years, it's a wonderful little ground that they've built themselves in Quito.
They've got to qualify first, Ollie.
Yeah, I know. And
if you look at the group that IDV are in, which is Group F, right? So Palmeiras on 7 points, IDV on 4, Liverpool on 4, San Lorenzo on 1. But IDV have to go to San Lorenzo, not easy, and they have to go to Palmeiras before, let's say they'll beat Liverpool at home on the final day. But I mean, they need points from those two games.
Sure.
They need one win from those.
Sure, and a point I think would have been much different if they'd held on for a point against Palmeiras and they, on home soil, that they weren't able to do this week. If IDV don't qualify out of that group, you can book me down for the group stages next year. Honestly.
Then they win the Sudamericana.
They would walk that competition at the moment because that is a travesty. I mean, I would like to get your thoughts on... You had delve into the world of the Sudamericana a bit more, and I just want to know if your opinion has changed slightly.
Been pushing for the South American Conference League. I mean, the Sudamericana, I mean, what do you think the early rounds of the Europa League look like?
Oh, definitely.
It's but the I also same know thing, that the... man. But also the Champions League. I mean, I don't think the match day 3 for me this week was where this competition started to come alive a bit. Like IDV 2 Palmeiras 3 is like quite exciting. Peñarol, you know, nearly pinched a 3-3. I think there were some exciting games this week, and I think it's the same in the Champions League. The first couple of match weeks it's like, oh, okay, maybe sides, there's just a bit less intensity, there's a little bit less jeopardy. I think now super exciting, and I think because I know the question was about the Sudamericana, but just on the Libertadores, loads of the Libertadores groups are really tight. And match day 5, yeah, and match day 6 is always a few dead rubbers, but match day 5 is going to be massive, and match day 6, of course, for the last game of the group. But I think it's cool that there's so many tight groups. Sudamericana hasn't got going, but when you reach the knockout phase, it does become exciting. Sides drop down from the Copa Lib, and that last 16 is good.
Yeah, but I the Conference League can't come in now, surely.
The only thing is, I think it's like, how does it make money? So, because the Sudamericana is probably enough prize money, and to be fair, it's only in Venezuela where there's no crowds, really. Like, I did a game from Ecuador in the Sudamericana this week. Like, decent crowd, like, for a Sudamericana game. The Argentine clubs will always deliver a good crowd. The Brazilians, like, grounds will swell a little bit when you get to the knockout. So, there obviously, like, is money in the Sudamericana. The Comfortable Conference League.
I don't think they have enough stadiums.
I was thinking about this. I don't think you could justify the travel because it does cost to take a squad of 20 and all the coaching staff across the continent. It's thousands that will cost.
But like the number of teams not playing in their home ground and playing in a 40,000-seater stadium, I mean, that national stadium in Asuncion gets used like 3 nights in a row. Sometimes it feels like on these Libertadores and Sudamericana nights. I genuinely don't think there's the infrastructure to have another round of... group stage games.
So here's what you do, Ollie.
A week.
You make it, it's the Comfortable Conference League, but you make it geographical at first, right? So you divide the continent up into maybe like a half or a quarter.
Obviously, the Brazilian and Argentinian sides get a bye past this round of the competition, I imagine, as seems to be the case with the league standing.
You could figure out how to work it. Okay. But essentially, let's say, I'm just looking at a map of the continent now. Let's say if you took from kind of São Paulo down, so you'd have the clubs in Asuncion, São Paulo, like Porto Alegre, Rio, Buenos Aires, Santiago, like that, and then the top half of the continent up. So you do something like that, and then you'd figure out a way to make it a bit more financially viable for everyone. People would still tune in, man. The Brazilian clubs in the Argentine, maybe you just weight it more heavily, as it is anyway, for the Brazilian and Argentine clubs who are going to get crowds. But I think it's on. I mean, I mentioned the Sudamericana's only been around 20 odd years, and we're creating competitions in the world now out of thin air. Like Conference League just suddenly arrived, and that's like a thing now. Like the Nations League is a few years old. Club World Cup's getting even bigger. World Cup's even bigger. Like there'll be the idea that there's going to be new tournaments across the board in the world.
What was the phrase I used with somebody? Somebody was telling me something about there was an expansion to another sports tournament taking place, and I was like, stop giving us what we want because we don't know what's good for us. We're like addicted to sport. And we keep wanting more of it because tournaments finish and everyone goes, oh, I wish we could have more of that. And then the organisers go, we could make more money by doing more of that. So they give us more of it. And we're like, oh, this is kind of as good, but actually I preferred the last thing. And
it's like the first two chocolate hobnobs are like great, fantastic. Everyone wins, no harm done, delicious. And then at the end of the packet, it's just like, oh, get it away from me. No. Like, can I just have a break? But you can't because it's so like Moorish. That's what the Conference League is.
South American football, the chocolate hobnobs. It feels great at first and then you dive into a few others, and you're like, I don't need it.
I just think, man, let me just look at the Brazilian standings, Ollie?
There's four teams that aren't involved in anything.
Okay. So, and what do you know what
the bottom four? No, I don't know off the top of my head, but we're only four games into the season in Brazil.
But yeah, this is weekend four, isn't it? Yeah. But I mean, why shouldn't those clubs be
why should they be the ones that miss out?
Well, why shouldn't they be playing midweek, mate? I mean, like, so if you look at it
Cruzeiro,
at the moment,
Sao Paulo, Vasco, and Criciúma.
Yeah, okay, so there's. Yeah,
there's
okay.
Three big names there.
It is really funny. When you look at
Cruzeiro and Sao Paulo.
When you look at the Brazilian table, it's hilarious that 1 to 12 are involved in some kind of European competition, 17 to 20 are relegated, and 13, 14, 15, and 16. But Vasco da Gama, like, big club. Sao Paulo, I mean, three times.
That's what I mean. Cruzeiro finally back in continental competitions this year in the Sudamericana. Three draws, not too great. I mean, out of those teams, right, RB Bragantino have gone to the Copa Sudamericana final and been in the semi-finals, I think, twice in the last 3 years. Flamengo, big side. Botafogo, big side. Atlético Paranaense, Libertadores winner. Grêmio, Libertadores winner. Internacional, Libertadores winner. I mean, Fortaleza will win the Copa Sudamericana for this year or at some point because they're great, really attacking side. Atlético Mineiro, Libertadores winner. Bahia, not so big. Juventud and Bahia, not so big. So you'd take Cruzeiro and Sao Paulo, replace those out. Fluminense, Palmeiras. And then you're into the no man's land four. And then you've got Corinthians, Cuiabá, who are in the CONMEBOL Sudamericana this year, Vitória and Atlético Goianiense in the bottom four. They're only maybe... look, and again, we're lucky we cover South American football, so maybe these names are a bit more relatable to us. But there are only maybe four sides that I would say I've never seen a game of in the Brazilian league at this point in my life, which is something I didn't really think I'd ever get to say in my work career, let alone my private life, to be honest.
He's coming around slowly but surely.
No, I'm not. I'm saying, why are all of these clubs suddenly considered big clubs? I mean, isn't that what makes football great as well, though? The fact that we're looking at a Brazilian league side where Corinthians, right now, if the league season ended after three games, would be relegated. And Cruzeiro have only just come back from the second division of Brazilian football. And there are a number of these big sides that have spent their time and done their kind of hard graft in the second tier of Brazilian football, which I actually think shows you that you can have a competitive league that has promotion and relegation without these big clubs getting too namby-pamby, hoity-toity about, oh, what if we go down? We need to be guaranteed an automatic place in this competition, otherwise it's not fair.
Well, Ollie, let's take IDV, right? It was their... you know, they're a football club that's obviously massively benefited from continental competition. Is there another IDV in Ecuador? Just looking around the list of Ecuadorian clubs. And to be honest, I only need to venture outside the top four or five to realise that the names do start to slip away from me. I mean, definitely. Have we ever heard of, you know, Mushuc Runa? I have actually heard of.
Yeah.
Orense, Ibabura. Now we're struggling, aren't we?
Yeah, we're getting
Cumbaya,
out of there.
Delfina down there. And Libertad. Libertad of Ecuador.
Yeah, not...
who were only found in 2017. Like, do we need them playing in the conference league? Maybe we do. But I'm just saying... It's not about what I think or what Ollie thinks. I think you look at the trajectory of how many games of football there are in the world. I don't see why, like, the third quarter of most leagues don't get to compete in continental competition.
Why then aren't we extending it down to the Brazilian second division? Because there's big sides like Chapecoense, Santos in there. I mean, they surely deserve a right to be playing on
don't.
The...
because they're not in the top tier.
So that's where the line
is.
That's the
line,
okay,
yeah.
All right, the top tier.
Yeah, the top tier. You can't have a... no.
Just say it, Santos.